President Hamilton of the Central Office took over as took over the administration of the campus personally. Came down, met with the faculty. He distributed a memo to the faculty under date of November 13, 1961. So the termination of President Lee's office, term in office, took place sometime before that. And it's interesting. It says, to the faculty of the Long Island Center, we have been through some difficult times. No one has been more troubled by them than I have. While for some time the only possible eventual resolution has been evident to me, I had hoped that it would come about in a different manner. That's an interesting paragraph, and I read into it that he had hoped that Lee would resign, that they wouldn't have to fire him.
I think they offered to let him resign.
Did they? Yes, he refused. I didn't know that, but that's what one would conclude from this. these were often science majors, but the main point is that never in the humanities, never in the social sciences, even though they had minimum requirements to take in those fields, were they asked to do a paper. And that's one of the penalties you pay by having very large lecture classes and taking multiple choice exams. So when they come to write a paper, they learn to their astonishment that they don't know how to write. They don't know how to put a sentence together. They don't know how to punctuate. They don't use good grammar. Their spelling is atrocious simply because we have failed miserably in making opportunities available to students to practice these skills. Writing is not something you take courses in. Writing is something you do, and you have to do a lot of it. And we did a lot of writing in the early days at Oyster Bay. Now, part of our goal was achieved by the curricular structure. And the curricular structure was one which was developed so that it would be a common experience for all students. And so all students took Humanities 1 and Humanities 2, and all students took Social Sciences 1 and Social Sciences 2, and all students took Natural Sciences 1 and Natural Sciences 2. Because regardless of what they plan to go into eventually, the idea was that they have a common core of educational experience. What we call a core today, how hard we are working, we have a course called CORE. That is not a core of educational experience. In those days, students actually had something to talk about with one another. They had common readings, they had discussions in different sections of the same topics, and so they could compare how different instructors approached the same topic. We had open visitation between classes and instructors so that we could visit any class at any time and see what's going on. Not done for assessment of the instructor, but done for purposes of self-enlightenment and acquaintance with what was actually going on educationally with the students. That is the best way to find out whether the students are becoming educated.
Access to different points of view.
Different points of view, and to actually see if, as I did at one time, I attended a Humanities 2 course during an entire semester with Harold Ziskin as instructor, and he was such a skillful teacher. And you can see the minds of the students beginning to encompass difficult and sophisticated ideas. And you could compare where they started at the beginning of the term with where they ended up at the end of the term. And it was for them a magnificent experience, and it certainly was for any of us who sat in and observed as well. The importance of this is that Leonard Olson and Ellen Ostall took a personal interest in the nature of the education that the students were getting, not in terms of how many courses they were getting, and not in terms of calculating totals of hours, but in terms of what was actually happening to them intellectually. The examination schedule was, in the early days, was quite different too. We had a final examination at the end of a year, so that the students were asked to not to parrot back tracks, but to react in written papers on the materials that they had covered over the entire year.
Was there one at the end of the first semester?
There was in some courses. We had them in science and mathematics, but I think in humanities, that was at the end of the year, and so on. There are certain institutions still in this country that I believe that do not even examine you at the end of the year, but examine you in the fall of the next year, so that you have the summer to let things settle and ferment. And so so that you think in terms of larger concepts and not in terms of a little lot of facts which you have to memorize. And I think that was a striking difference in the approach, in the education approach that characterized the early days of Oyster Bay. And as I also think, even though Alan Austell was technically dean of students, he took as intense an interest in the academic dimension of what was happening to students as anyone in the faculty. He was fully aware of what was going on, and of course he perhaps even had a better insight because he talked to students who were in trouble and students who were not, and learned a lot about what was going on in classes that way.
That explains where he is now.
He is now retired, but he was the dean of a new school in New York City, and he's now chancellor. They created the position just for him.
Is that right?
Upon his retirement. So he's chancellor. He is chancellor of the new school, but he was dean of the new school prior to that time. Let me turn then to what happened in around 1960 and 61, when our mission began to enlarge. The State University had renamed somewhere around 60 or 61 parts of Long Island as Long Island Center. So it was called State University of New York Long Island Center. And that was about the time that they decided there should be four university centers around the state.
The master plan is dated, I think, 60.
That's probably, yes. Well, I don't know when it actually was implemented as far as we are concerned.
Yeah.
I have two documents here, both 1960-61. One is called College of Long Island, one is called Long Island Center. So that approximately. And I think it was probably handed down, not as officially as a news release from Albany or something like that, the way such things sometimes happen. At any rate, that expansion of mission began with the addition of an engineering authorization for Bunker. And there was the same kind of concern expressed at that time about engineering education as for other kinds of education. We had a large meeting, which was participated in, and I guess in a sense sponsored by, although I don't remember the details of this, General Electric. And they came and we had many discussions about the nature of what an engineering curriculum should be in the 1960s, which we were entering. Prior to that time, engineering had been classified in the traditional ways into mechanical, electrical, and civil, and so on. The General Electric men believed that that was an unfortunate way to go, and that that teaching engineering students the specifics of civil and mechanical engineering was futile if you didn't end up in a particular kind of engineering company that used those particular applications. They thought instead that students should be very well founded in the basic sciences and mathematics, along with some fundamentals of engineering type courses. Material sciences, for example, was something that hardly existed in those days. electronics, their position was that if you give us a student who is well educated in the fundamentals of all of these areas, we can train them in the applications in a period of weeks. You give us a student who is specially trained in a particular area and we want him for a different area, we have to train him from scratch. And so they proposed essentially a new engineering curriculum at the time, which we endorsed.
Hardware free.
Well, that original goal has been compromised, of course, in the succeeding years, but there are still some vestiges of that around. Now,
who brought in GE? Do you have it?
Well, I think Leonard did. I don't know what the chain of events was there. I still have it somewhere. They put out a beautiful brochure just for this meeting where they indicated the outline for discussion that we would all engage in. And it was so harmonious with,
okay, go ahead,
with what we were trying to do. So harmonious with what we were trying to do that, of course, we endorsed this principle for the organization of an engineering curriculum. The next job was to recruit a dean of engineering. And through a series of events that I have no personal knowledge of, the man from North Carolina State by the name of John F. Lee appeared on the scene to be interviewed as a candidate for the dean of engineering position. Now, John Lee was a very charming, verbal person, and in his interview with the council who was involved at that time, and with the faculty, he made a very good impression.
See now, was Judge Sullivan chairman then, or
yes.
Was Ward Melville still chairman?
No, Ward Melville was honorary chairman, and William J. Sullivan was chairman of the board.
Yeah. Right.
And I, to be honest, don't think that here is the 1959-1960 bulletin, and Melville was still chairman at that time. But I think that was about the time when he became honorary chairman, and Jeff Sullivan became chairman, actual chairman of the council. At any rate, such appointments as that were for the upper positions were actually recommended by the council to
even the deans then.
Oh yes. And along the way, as I say, I was not involved in this, John F. Lee made such a good impression that some people began to ask, why don't we, since we're also looking for a president, why don't we consider him as president? And I suppose that fell upon sympathetic ears, since I'm not sure just what stage the presidential search was in at that time. It was about the time we wanted to recruit a president before the move to Stony Brook. And so it was in its early stages. Now, that must have taken...
Let me stop you there. Just
yes.
A sec.
Right.
Because, and here I don't remember who, but somewhere in the interviews, somebody said that Leonard Olson made such an impressive set of recommendations
came about, he was recommended for the presidency and was approved by the council and was approved by the Board of Trustees in Albany. Now, that must have been sometime in the fall of 1960, so far as I don't know the exact time frame there. At any rate, he was due to arrive on campus in at the beginning of the second semester. So in the 60-61 academic year, he arrived on campus.
Early in 61.
I think, to be precise, it was in February, early February of 1961. Now, about 2 weeks after he arrived on campus, he called a special meeting of the faculty. To be precise, it was called on Tuesday, February the 28th at 3:30 in the afternoon in the Great Hall, which is in the Cole Mansion. Business of this is a notice from the secretary of the faculty, who was Bill Lister at that time. The business of the meeting will consist exclusively of an address by the president. So we all gathered in the Great Hall and were addressed by President Lee. He later distributed a detailed copy of his remarks. And they run to, well, I'm not sure how many pages here, but 20-odd double-spaced pages. And there is no question about it, it was a tour de force. It was setting out the goals for the institution, presenting the challenges of a new president, talking about the mission of Stony Brook, dramatizing C.P. Snow's Two Cultures and the Scientific Revolution, saying such things as the scientific and humanistic cultures must be joined, those were his words, stressing the quality of the faculty, and the need for a distinguished faculty of teacher scholars, addressed the question of the responsibility of the faculty in some detail, kinds of committees and so on, how the faculty would be organized in terms of departmentalization. We provided tables of organization at that time. Talked about the challenges of the move between from Oyster Bay to Stony Brook. He applauded the fact that we had an absence of the evils of big-time intercollegiate sports, called them flamboyant sideshows. He said all of the right things. And then he went into administrative organization and took up the whole question of communication between administration, faculty, and students. Communication is a lifeblood which nourishes and purifies both bones and flesh. Then he talked about the what his administrative structure would look like. And he first addressed the post of Dean of Faculty, and this was the post that Leonard Olson was then going to occupy. He was never intended to be president. He was to start the institution, and then he would stay on as dean. He was always dean. He was never called president. And he says that he should be the president's alter ego, but should unreluctant to play the devil's advocate on behalf of the faculty. He must have the moral power to keep uppermost in the president's mind what is truly best for the primary mission of the university. He is, in a very real sense, the president's chief advisor and confidant. Then he talked about the dean of students, academic senate, student government, all of which was well in place at that time. He talked about the academic divisions, and he had a concept of... I'll get to that in just a minute. Talked about the graduate... joined in strength.